Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is December 13th, 2018, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Febrile Seizure Recurrence, With or Without You, Acetaminophen. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Damian Rowland. Damian is a consultant at the University of Leicester, NHS Trust, and Honorary, you're an honorary associate professor for the University of Leicester Sapphire Group. He specializes in pediatric emergency medicine and is a passionate believer that education exists to be shared, i.e. FOMED. Welcome to the SGEM, Damian.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know what? I am very surprised that a rock star like you has time to even record with me, because don't forget the Bubble Team, which you're part of, is now famous after your Lego study went viral. Can you briefly explain to that one or two people out there who haven't heard of this epic Lego study you got published?
It's amazing what people enjoy reading and sharing. We just had a fun idea for a Christmas journal to let's do some self-experimentation. We commonly see children who swallow a bit of Lego. So we all, or six of us, swallowed a Lego head ourselves just to see how long it took to pass through our bodies as an example of how safe swallowing small bits of Lego can be. And out of the six of us, we found that the average Lego head passed in 1.7 days. And we just used that to explore a bit of fun, a bit of safe science. And it was so nice that it got picked up by so many news outlets. We were able to explore some real knowledge translation in promoting a message that button batteries, something that children also do swallow, are quite dangerous. And that's something that parents should watch out for.
Well, it wasn't just in the medical media. It was in the mainstream media. I think I read an article in Forbes magazine. You were on some late night TV shows. I mean, give us some more there.
It just captured people's imagination. I never dreamed in my wildest years that some of my research would be mentioned by James Corden on kind of American television. But it's nice to see things kind of spread around. It's been lots of learning in how press releases work. And actually, as a team, we've had a bit of a discussion about how we utilize some of our learning in terms of knowledge translation for future, perhaps more rigorous studies.
Well, I didn't do a full skeptical review on it, but I did put my skeptical eye upon it. And I noticed that you had a fart score and a shat score. Neither one has been validated. And I don't think either one will ever be validated. What is a fart score and a shat score?
Well, I must say, so that the fart score is the found and retrieve time, which was an average of 1.7 days between the six of us. I'm particularly proud of the shat score because that's something I made up myself. And also, one of the sentences in the paper reads that the stool hardness and transit time score is subject to a bit of intra-user variability, but one of its main benefits is that users can shat themselves with minimal training.
Well, you didn't calculate a number needed to swallow, and I wasn't sure if that was because you mentioned there were six of you, but five of you were able to retrieve the Lego head in roughly 1.7 days. But there was one individual that went through 13 bowel movements over a two-week period and was not able to retrieve the Lego head.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the secret's out yet. That was me. It wasn't a fun experience. I looked through my own poo every day for 2 weeks. I have an electronic diary to describe each poo during the month of May when we did it. Not something I particularly enjoyed doing, and not something I am ever going to repeat.
Well, I think it was just a fantastic, fantastic study. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes to this publication. And in my humble opinion, I think your group deserves an ignoble prize in medicine for 2019.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's get to a case. What do you got?
So you're working in your emergency department. It's early evening and an 18-month-old presents having had a febrile convulsion, or sometimes called a febrile seizure, at home. The seizure lasted about a minute, and actually now it's been a couple of hours since the seizure occurred. The infant's completely back to their normal self. Observations all within normal parameters, except a small fever. And you've got a clear focus. You look at that right eardrum and it's bulging, it's red, it's inflamed, it looks painful. You have a chat with the parents, you discuss what's happened and the likely outcomes for future events. You give some really robust safety net advice, and you clearly describe to the parents that just giving regular antipyretics isn't going to stop another febrile convulsion occurring. And you give the time-honored advice that really what you should be doing is concentrating on the distress caused by fever rather than the fever itself. And you're quite chuffed with yourself when the parents leave the consultation room, quite happy with what's happened. But when you've left, a medical student who's been watching you comes up and says, "You've just told those parents you can't stop febrile convulsions occurring, but I've got a publication here from Japan that clearly states that regular rectal acetaminophen significantly reduces the risk of recurrence."
Ooh, so the student brought up the primary literature and actually presented you with a paper, not the, "Oh, you know, I heard this on a podcast" or something crazy like that. So that's a good case. Thank you. Let's review some background information on febrile seizures, because we know that they're very common, but we also know that they can be very, very, let's put three varies in there, scary for caregivers and parents. I mean, often they will come in running quite distressed that their child has had this convulsion or seizure. And during the winter months, and I don't want to receive any jokes about Canada that there's August and winter, but during the winter months, a typical emergency department may well see a child a day presenting with a febrile seizure.
Yeah, so these are common, sometimes a day, sometimes more than a couple of days. But Rosenblum looked at a systematic review of a load of publications around febrile seizures published in 2013 in the European Journal of Pediatric Neurology, and they concluded that antipyretics were ineffective in reducing febrile seizure recurrence rate.
Well, we covered that paper with pediatric superhero Anthony Crocco on SGEM number 95. And our bottom line from that one was, antipyretics appear to offer no significant improvement in the recurrent rate of febrile seizures in children.
But having said that, fever fear is a real concern for parents. And often the first question they will ask you when you've counseled about a febrile convulsion is, "Should I give regular paracetamol or acetaminophen, because will that stop the fever occurring?"
Yeah, and they come in looking for their child to be evaluated, obviously, and they're also looking for reassurance. They don't want this to happen again. But we have to fall back to some of the guidelines, and the American Academy of Pediatrics say, quote, "Fever in and of itself is not known to endanger a generally healthy child. In contrast, fever may actually be of benefit. Thus, the real goal of antipyretic therapy is not simply to normalize body temperature, but to improve the overall comfort and well-being of the child," end of quote.
Yeah, and so we take that advice further and we tell parents and carers of children who have had febrile convulsions that regular administration of an antipyretic won't reduce the risk of recurrence. But this recent publication in Pediatrics has maybe challenged that position.
Well, what's the clinical question then?
So, does the regular administration of acetaminophen reduce the risk of immediate recurrence of a febrile seizure in children?
And what's the reference from Japan?
So, Morita et al., acetaminophen and febrile seizure recurrences during the same fever episode, published in 2018 in Pediatrics.
Let's run through the PICO. What was the population that they included?
So they took infants and children 6 to 60 months old attending an emergency department at a single Japanese city hospital.
And they had some exclusion criteria, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
So they took rectal acetaminophen, 10 milligrams per kilogram, at presentation, and then they gave it every 6 hours until 24 hours after the onset of the febrile seizure.
And what did they compare it to?
So they compared it to no treatment, i.e. nothing at all, for 24 hours after the onset of the febrile seizure.
What was their primary outcome of interest?
Seizure recurrence during that same fever episode.
And I'll put the secondary outcomes in the show notes. The author's conclusions were, quote, "Acetaminophen is a safe antipyretic against febrile seizures and has the potential to prevent febrile seizure recurrence during the same febrile episode. End of quote. All right, Damien, let's run through the quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. The first question always, are these patients presenting to the emergency department?
Yes, they are.
Did they adequately randomize the patients?
Yes, they did. They used random number tables.
Did they conceal the randomization?
We're not sure about that. It's probably the case, but they didn't document it specifically.
Did they analyze the groups into which they were randomized?
No, they didn't. It appears that patients were excluded from the analysis rather than being part of an intention to treat.
The study patients were recruited consecutively.
Yeah, we're not sure about that. It wasn't explicitly stated, and nearly a third of the potential population were excluded.
The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yeah, again, we're not sure about that, but they reported no significant difference.
And all participants, were they unaware of their group allocation?
No, this wasn't a blinded study.
Question 8, all groups were treated equally except for the intervention.
Yep, that's true.
Was their follow-up complete?
Yes, it was.
Do you think they considered all patient-important outcomes?
I suspect they did.
And the final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Yes, in this case it was.
All right, let's run through the key results. They had just over 400 children randomized in this trial to either rectal acetaminophen or no antipyretics. The median age was about 20 months, a quarter had a history of a febrile seizure, and 16% had a febrile seizure in this study. So what was the big key result?
So febrile seizure recurrence rate was significantly lower with rectal acetaminophen compared to no antipyretic treatment.
All right, so let's get a little bit more detail on that primary outcome. Can you give us some numbers?
Yeah, so it was different. 9.1% in the intervention group versus 23.5% in the control group. For what it's worth, the p-value was 0.001.
Yeah, and that gave you an absolute difference of 14.4%, or a number needed to treat of 7. So you had to treat 7 children to prevent 1 febrile seizure recurrence. How about the secondary outcomes?
Well, they had 4 variables: rectal acetaminophen use, the age of the patient, the duration of seizure, and rectal acetaminophen and age combined. And those 4 were independently associated with febrile seizure recurrence.
Well, those are the key results. Guess what I want to do now, Damien?
Let's do it. Let's talk nerdy.
Yes. Okay. Well, the first thing I wanted to talk about was exclusions. And we sort of hinted about that before. They excluded about 1/3 of potential patients for a variety of reasons. But if you looked at it, the vast majority of patients were excluded because the patient had already been given a diazepam suppository to prevent a febrile seizure, or the parents requested the use of a diazepam suppository. Now, we always like to see consecutive inclusions, and some of these exclusions could have introduced some selection bias into the trial.
Yeah, so let's move on to some blinding issues. So the trial wasn't blinded, which in itself isn't always a problem, but there's no placebo group. And actually, there could have introduced a lot of bias because of self-reporting of parents to favor acetaminophen. Because there could have been a placebo group, in my opinion, they could have used a sham per-rectal agent that just had no impact, but at least the parent was doing something, and so I think that may have reduced some of the bias in terms of self-reporting. We're also unsure if both groups were similar with regards to prognostic factors because we had no confidence intervals provided around the point estimates.
Oh, so you don't have any confidence intervals in those point estimates. So even though they said the prognostic factors weren't different, we don't know how confident we are about that statement because they didn't give us confidence intervals. Is that right?
That's the one.
All right. So let's talk about intention to treat analysis. And we mentioned this earlier. It appears they did not perform an intention to treat analysis, which would again bias the results. And when I say bias, it's something that systematically moves us away from the truth. So this could potentially, again, introduce bias into the results towards the intervention, that rectal acetaminophen group.
Okay, so let's also have a look at external validity. So there is an issue here. Lots of patients were excluded from inclusion because they'd already received a rectal suppository of diazepam. Now, I never consider using a benzodiazepine to prophylactically treat a febrile seizure. It just doesn't happen. It's not routine practice in the UK. I'm not sure it is in many other international places around the world either. Now, if it was standard practice to do this in Japan, which it does appear to be the case, that does create two slightly different populations and does mean that this population in Japan might not be transportable to a population in the UK or Canada, for instance. In the UK, it'd be unheard of for parents to prefer to give medications via the rectal route, and they often give them orally.
Yeah, and we often give them orally here, so and it would be unusual or rare for a parent to prefer a rectal route, and I'm hearing from you the UK is like that, but clearly Japan is different, and there may be other countries. I think Germany also is similar with regards to using this as, you know, standard rectal administration of medication.
Yes, and so there are those cultural or social differences that do need to be considered in the applicability of studies like this.
All right, the fifth and final point we want to talk about is about ethics. And it's an ethical consideration of withholding antipyretics from a febrile child. And we've already discussed the AAP guidelines that recommend treating for comfort, not to lower the temperature.
Yeah, I'll be really honest. It made me more than just a bit skeptical about the results. It made me a little angry. Withholding antipyretic treatment in a sick febrile child, it could be considered unethical because forget the fever. We're not interested in the fever. You've got a child who's distressed. No pediatrician in their right mind, actually, it's not about pediatrics. No doctor in their right mind is going to leave a child distressed when you could give something to treat that discomfort. I don't think that this trial needed to have a complete placebo-free arm. You could have easily have compared regular, if you needed to give rectal agents, against normal treatment. A normal treatment would be you get paracetamol or acetaminophen if you have a distressed child.
Yeah, it did make me feel a little uncomfortable as well. But those are the five nerdy points we wanted to talk about. It's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So we disagreed with the author's conclusions given the methodological limitations we've just discussed.
How about a bottom line then?
As always, treat a febrile child with antipyretics for comfort, not to normalize the temperature or prevent a recurrent febrile seizure.
And that child that had that bulging eardrum that you suspected had otitis media, can you give a case resolution?
Yeah, so you'd give that child some acetaminophen, paracetamol, or some ibuprofen, not to bring down the fever or prevent a febrile seizure, just because you want to reduce their pain. That otitis media, even without a fever, could be painful. You're giving something to the child to reduce their discomfort. Not for fever, not for febrile seizure recurrence.
And to be clear, you're going to give this orally, not rectally.
Yeah, certainly in the UK.
Okay. Now, we've talked about this, and it is good to come across papers that challenge the certain beliefs that we hold based on the existing literature. So this paper challenges the existing literature on this topic. So how are you going to take this new paper out of Japan that's using rectal acetaminophen to prevent febrile seizures and then apply it clinically to your practice?
Well, there's two lessons that I've learned here. So one of them is about the external validity, or I'm going to create this term, cultural validity. I don't practice using per-rectal agents, and it makes me a little uncomfortable that you'd have to do that regularly, but it's completely normal practice in Japan and as Germany, as we've mentioned, and it's not really for me to judge that. This isn't a scientific, evidence-based debate. This is one of social context and culture. So just because that makes me feel uncomfortable doesn't necessarily mean it's not right. So I think that's an important thing to consider when we're thinking about the paper. But actually, given the design of this study, my belief is that you don't need to work so hard to reduce a recurrence rate, which doesn't feel right to me. So it was about a 15% recurrence rate. I do not see in my practice 1 to 2 children presenting or returning after I've discharged them. So there was something about this population that is different than the population I see. But the last thing, and I think it's good for everyone to think about this, is the maths or the science of this particular study did demonstrate that you can, compared to no treatment, which again we think is a little odd, you can, if you give rectal PR agents, reduce febrile seizures. So that does call into question our advice when we say to parents, there's nothing that we can do to reduce a recurrence. Actually, that's now a bit of a gray area, and we need to think of our terminology in that regard.
It's a good point to make that we shouldn't get so entrenched in our own held positions, because you know what? New information will come up, and it may challenge what we hold to be true. And we, as skeptics, need to incorporate that and reflect upon that and decide, is it enough to change our position? Because just because we're skeptical doesn't mean we can't change our minds, given good, high-quality evidence. And I think the major issue for me is the external validity. So while this paper says if you give regular rectal acetaminophen to a child with a fever in Japan, in those Japanese children, you can reduce the risk of recurrent febrile seizures. But how does that apply to me giving oral acetaminophen for comfort in a febrile child? And will that prevent a febrile seizure? And that's the question that still remains open, because the data we have says no, it won't.
Yep, and there's actually one last point, is about the way that language is used. So in this paper, they talked about recurrent febrile convulsions, but it's important that that was in the same episode or the same fever illness duration. There is also the recurrence risk in the future, in 6 months' time, a year's time, and that's not what this study was about. And there's a potential for a bit of confusion when people kind of think that you're preventing future febrile convulsions, which you're not. This was simply about, can you stop another one happening in that same illness?
I think that's a good point to clarify. So now what are you going to tell your parents or caregivers who have brought this child in with their febrile seizure? What's the conversation that you have?
So when we've ensured that we know what the focus is, we're happy that the child is safe to go home, the key thing that I emphasize is the commonality of this. So parents have seen the most distressing thing that they may ever witness that occur in their child, and they are fearful that their child may die, they're fearful that they may have epilepsy or ongoing seizures, and they're fearful they may have had meningitis. And I find it quite reassuring to them to hear that this is common. We do see 1 to 2 a day, and actually it's not unusual for this to happen, that there is a low risk of developing epilepsy in the future. And I lay it on thick about this concept that the fever itself is probably a good thing for the child, and what we're aiming to do is reduce distress. And that certainly by regularly applying acetaminophen or paracetamol, we're not going to stop harm occurring. And actually, we're reducing our ability to reduce the child's distress. Because if you give paracetamol just because, you lose your time window. What I mean by that is if you give it every 4 hours, you're stuck if that fever comes back in those 4 hours. You're much better giving some treatment when they're distressed and waiting for as long as that paracetamol works. And then when the fever does return and then it causes distress, you may be able to give another agent. You can't do that if all you're doing every 4 hours is giving another dose.
I think that's really important, because one of the takeaways from this study is I didn't want a parent or caregiver ever to feel guilty that they weren't on top of the fever, the temperature, enough, and that because that fever or temperature was not controlled, that that's why their child had a febrile seizure, and somehow they're responsible, they're not a good parent, and the guilt associated with that. So I always want to be reassuring that, you know, they have the best interest of their child at heart, and they're trying their best, and it's to focus on the child's comfort and use that as your cue.
Yeah, definitely. And they know their child best. That parents are excellent at knowing when there's that subtle change in behavior. They can predict the temperature even before it occurs because they can see the distress occurring, the slight lethargy, the glazed look. And I validate the parent's health expertise in that regard.
I think that's such an excellent point. I mean, I do it with adult patients all the time when I'm doing shared decision making, and I tell them, I said, I am the expert at the medical literature and medicine, but you are the expert at you. You're an expert at you. And this is the same thing with a parent or caregiver. They are the expert at their child. They know the child better than I know them. I've just had a brief interaction with them. And so I'm always saying to parents, listen, you know, besides the things that you want them to watch out for, I usually say if you're just something's not right with your child, you may not be able to put your finger on it, but you know what? Something's telling you that there's something off with your child. You know your child better. Bring them back. Happy to see your child again.
Definitely.
All right, that brings us to the Keener contest, and we had a number of people with the correct answer last week. The first correct answer, though, came from Dr. Ali Hines, an EM resident from Mercy St. Vincent in Toledo, Ohio. She knew Henry Dale was the researcher working in the Wellcome Physiological Research Laboratories in 1906, and he insisted on using the name adrenaline in all his publications. Damien, what's the question this week?
So you need to name the clinical pharmacologist that first tried paracetamol or acetaminophen on humans in 1887.
Well, if you know the answer, be the first person to email thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line, and I will mail you a cool skeptical prize. There are some other FOMED resources on febrile seizures, and in particular, the Don't Forget the Bubbles team did a blog post on febrile seizures on this particular paper. I will put a link in the show notes for those additional FOMED resources. But I want to thank you, Damien, for coming on the SGEM to discuss febrile seizures.
It's an absolute honor to have been invited. Thank you very much.
And are there any new Don't Forget the Bubble research plan for 2019? Like, I don't know, sticking a Lego head up your nose or something?
I'm sure we will come up with something, and we're very much looking forward to the Don't Forget the Bubbles conference in June of 2019 in London, and maybe we'll give you an idea of what we have planned then.
Ooh, yeah. So save the date. Next year, June 2019, Don't Forget the Bubbles conference in the UK. All right, Damien, one last thing to do. You need to throw on your thickest Leicester accent and give us the tagline.
So remember, be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.